Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Hope you're all feeling well, doing well in these weirdo times. We're brought together, unfortunately, once again, because of the passing of a former guest. This week it is Don Wilson of The Ventures. He was the rhythm guitar player, one of the founders of the band. He died at age 88 up in Tacoma, Washington, where the band was formed way back in 1958. They had an amazing career, just tons and tons of records. I guess they were the most influential, successful instrumental band from the United States, period, of all time. A record I can't imagine ever broken. We get into all kinds of ups and downs of the band, and just a sweet, interesting guy. He starts off laughing in the interview, which I always think is a good sign. He's nice and relaxed. And one interesting thing about him, he was the band's rhythm guitar player, and I think that was a role he sort of relished. He loved being the rhythm guitar player and holding it down, driving the music. You don't always sort of get that sentiment from the rhythm guitar player. I guess he was also sort of the, maybe the unofficial leader of the band. Anyways, interesting band, great history, great music, tons and tons of records if you're interested to check out. And of course, we play a bunch of them in the archived version of this show. You can find that over at wfmu.org/Michael. That's it. My email, michaels@wfmu.org. Get in touch. Say hello, and check out this interview with me and Don Wilson. It is from September 2008, a while back. We pay tribute to the late, great Don Wilson. Yeah, there's the twomp from The Ventures wrapping up a set of fantastic Ventures music. I put my headphones on for about the last minute of that song, and it sounds fantastic, like most Ventures records do sound fantastic. On the telephone, the voice of the twomp, Don Wilson, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Michael. You know, I was surprised to hear, I haven't heard that for years.
I guess the dance craze didn't quite...
Sounded pretty good, actually.
It's fantastic. I mean, that's a number one hit in my book, anyway.
Yeah, well, thank you.
This is the 50th anniversary of The Ventures. It's sort of hard to believe. It's such an amazing story, such an American story. 100 million records sold worldwide. Right. Without any doubt, the greatest selling instrumental band of all time, probably for eternity, I would imagine.
I hope so.
You told me you're a little bit jet-lagged because you just got back from Japan, right?
We did 45 shows in 55 days.
Oh, man, and that's...
That's all concerts, and it's all in different places, different cities, not the same place twice.
Yeah,
and you think, well, let's see, 55 out of 45, you got 10 days off. No, you don't. Seven of those were travel days.
Right, and how many...
We had 3 days off that whole time.
How many trips to Japan have you made?
I couldn't even count them. We started in 1962.
Yeah.
And probably, I think we've missed maybe 1 year or something since then. And we go twice a year, so I can't do the math on that.
It's tremendous. But you must have a lot of freaking flyer miles. That must be one of the upsides.
Yeah, I do. And a lot of, I could stay in any Hilton in the world for about a month, I think.
Well, maybe you need to go relax and get some room service. Were you born in Washington State?
Yeah, I was. I was born in Tacoma, Washington, and that's where we started, actually. I met my partner. I was selling used cars, and he came in to buy a used car. And I wasn't much of a salesman. I just, if I got to know somebody real well, like I did him, of course I didn't know who he was, and he came in and he said that somebody sent me in here that had purchased a car before, and he was a bricklayer, and I got to talking to him and everything, and I knew every car in the lot, if they ran good or they didn't or whatever, and I got to talking to him. We had a good rapport, we found out that each one of us knew a few chords on a guitar, and that was about it. I didn't even own a guitar, and he didn't either. We hadn't played one for a long time. So anyway, I asked him, I said, I'm not doing too good here. You know, I'm on a commission. I'm not selling many cars. What do you do? He said, I'm a bricklayer. I said, do you think you could get me on as a, you know, hod carrier or a laborer or something? I got to make some money. Come back about a month later, and he got me a job. We bought two guitars in a pawn shop in 1958, learned how to play them, bought chord books. In 1960, we had number two hit in the nation, which was Walk, Don't Run.
That's an amazing story. It was your father's used car lot, right?
Yeah, it was. It was my dad's. And that's even worse. You know, you're working for your dad.
And you couldn't sell any car. And this is, of course, Bob Bogle we're talking about, who was who really, and you and him started the Ventures. I do notice, though, that your first single, one side is vocal and one side is instrumental. If that vocal side had taken off, would the Ventures have been a vocal band, you think?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know. You know, it just so happened that it didn't. But, of course, Walk, Don't Run, we had a hard time selling that. I mean, that was turned down by a lot of people, the final recording. And if you listen to it, you know, well, I can't believe that. But, yeah, it was. It was turned down. You know, a guy here in Seattle, his name is Bob Reisdorf. He had a label called Dalton Records, and he had a group called the Fleetwoods that had Come Softly to Me. You would know that.
Sure.
And Mr. Blue, both number one hits. And we took it to him, and, you know, before we had it completed, and he said, well, I like it, but it's not just not quite there, you know. So anyway, we went in and recorded it, and then he heard it on the radio, and just locally, and he called up to say, who is that? That's a natural hit. And so he sent it down to Liberty Records in Los Angeles, who distributed for him, and they turned it down. They said, no, that's not a hit. We don't want it. And he said, well, go ahead and release it. If it loses money, I'll pay it. And it went on to be a number two hit in the nation.
It's an amazing story. I mean, it's a pretty fast, explosion for the band. I think you were first known as the Versatones, and you and Bob were just playing gigs together after your masonry job. Is that right?
Hey, you're very good. Yeah, you know, I'm glad to hear that, because a lot of people, you know, are not as aware as you are of we were called the Versatones. And I'll tell you why, is because we're just Bob and I. We didn't know a bass player or a drummer. And we were just learning, and of course, you know, even if we did know one, they had a job and they didn't want to play with us. So it was just he and I. And we used to do these talent shows, which turned out to be popularity contests, because you win through applause. The more people you have in the place, the more times you win. But no, he and I worked real hard, got chord books, and tried to learn everything we could. We started out learning, you know, the older songs, you know, not even, you know, kind of semi-rock.
But
it was just he and I, just the two of us.
And eventually you stumble on, I suppose it's that Chet Atkins version of Walk, Don't Run, which is a slightly jazzier, certainly less rockin' version than the Ventures.
Oh my gosh, yeah, we couldn't even start to play it. When we discovered Walk, Don't Run, as a matter of fact, my partner Bob, he had a album called Hi-Fi in Focus by Chet Atkins. I mean, there wasn't even stereo then. There was nothing but monaural. And, you know, all vinyl, of course. And he said, there's a song in there I really like, but I don't think we can play it. I said, well, let me listen to it. Let's see. And, of course, the way he played it, jazz and finger style, you know, we couldn't. So what we did was to simplify it, put it into a rock beat. And, you know, it took about a year and a half, really, for that song to develop into what we released and what you hear with Walk, Don't Run.
Yeah, that's amazing. Noki Edwards joins you on bass. He was just kind of a local guy in lots of bands.
Yeah, he was. But, see, he had been playing guitar since he was 5 years old. He was the premier guitar player in that small town of Tacoma, Washington. I think at the time the population was about 100,000. But anyway, we had met him on a TV show, local TV show, and we said, "Would you mind playing the bass on this song?" And he said, "No, that's okay."
He
played the bass.
Played the bass. Skip Moore played the drums. Now, all the record companies were saying no, so you and Bob and your mom, Josie, decided to start your own label, Blue Horizon, because you really believed in this recording. And I guess you had young families at the time. You had jobs with the bricklaying, and you were playing in the band. So your mom basically said, "Okay, I'm going to make this happen." But I assume she didn't know the first thing about the record business.
No, she didn't, but she was... She just thought we were really good, you know, thank God for that. And she got behind us, and she did a lot of legwork. I mean, she would set up, she learned the business later on, but all she needed to do was set up a session time. And, like the first record we did was called Cookies and Coke and the McCoy. And, or it might have been the real McCoy. I'm not sure. I can't remember. That's too far back. Anyway, she would set up it took us about 3-4 months as laborers, so to speak, and with families to save about $200, $250 to go in and record two songs in Seattle. And the first we recorded, we had 500 records pressed, and I think we wound up with 450 of them. We gave them away, of course. But anyway, then we went in and did Walk, Don't Run, and we thought, well, I'm not going to go pressing 500 of them, so we pressed 300. But she used to do a lot of legwork, and she took Walk, Don't Run to a lot of radio stations around the Seattle area, and they all turned it down, all of them.
Yeah, and then Pat O'Day decides to use it for his, in the hourly, play it right before the news, right?
That's right, yeah. He called it a news kicker. It kicks in the news. The news was always on 5 minutes before the hour. And what he did, he would play a song like Walk, Don't Run, he wouldn't say who did it or what it was. And the way he would get reaction out of it, of course, to see if people liked it or not, they would call up and want to know who it is and what song is it. And they said they really liked it. Well, the switchboard lit up. And, I mean, people kept calling and calling and calling. And that's when Bob Reisdorf heard it and, put it on Dalton label. And like I said, he sent it down to Liberty Records, and that president of Liberty Records said it's not a hit.
And then it was number two, September 1960. That's a big hit record. Did you guys go mental? Were you shocked?
Well, we were certainly happy, I can tell you that. We were ecstatic. Knowing the percentage of anything recorded, and especially instrumentals, were really tough, and still are.
Yeah.
We were pleasantly surprised, and yeah, you might say pretty close to being shocked. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got you and your mom and Bob, and to be a number two hit that quickly is, but the song's fantastic. So
And at any other time, it would have been number one. At any other time.
What kept you out?
It seems to be, sometimes this happens. Our competition, and a lot of older people out there don't know, I mean, younger people don't know a lot of songs that were done then, but older people do. And our competition was The Twist, Chubby Checker.
Yes.
Now or Never, Elvis Presley. Only the Lonely, Roy Orbison. Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Polka Dot Bikini. And that was the top five in that time.
Wow. Yeah,
it would switch from 3 to 1 and from 4 to whatever, and we stayed at 2 for about 2.5 months.
Wow.
We'd go out and buy the billboard and say, "God, I hope we're number one this time." No, we never were.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame, but, it's an amazing era of music. Every one of those songs is still played today,
Yes, that's right, and that was our competition. Those are the most, some of the most popular songs ever in the 60s.
Absolutely. The Twist was just named the most popular song ever from Billboard from the 60s, which is...
No kidding.
Yeah. Chubby Checker must be very happy.
Well, he must be happy, but he can't get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes, I want to talk to you about that. But first, let's go back. Howie Johnson finally joins the band, and he's now sort of the regular drummer of the band. And for the most part, the band moves to L.A., and you're sort of now on Liberty, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And, and you start...
Oh, well, we weren't on Liberty label, though. We were still on Dalton.
Right. Oh, Liberty bought Dalton? Is that what happened?
No, they did eventually, yeah.
Yeah, that's an amazing strategy. Just buy the whole company if they want the ventures.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, Bob Reisdorf was a pretty savvy businessman. And he told us, he said, you know, I'm going to sell the company to Liberty. And for one reason is because... Any artist generally is good for about two or three albums or singles or whatever. Then they're through. They're done. we at this point right now, we've released 250 different albums.
So he thought by 1963 you'd be back laying bricks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's pretty funny. You started this pattern of releasing albums, and although you got on the singles chart many times, you know, in the next 50 years, you really became known for making albums, concept albums, albums that worked as a whole, and releasing these great all the way through albums.
Yeah, right. We were responsible for 25% of Liberty Records' total volume for about 4 or 5 years.
That's amazing.
And we had 5 albums on the top 100 at one time.
Let me ask you a question.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing. Of the percentage of dollars that you deserve to be paid, what percentage do you think you actually have been paid from record companies?
Well, you know, when we started... that's an interesting question because it's really interesting. And what was happening at the time? When we had our four pieces, we had Noki, Bob, and me, and Howie Johnson. And what happened was that we thought, well, everybody's working as hard as anybody else. Let's just split it four ways. So we did, but we only got 4%. And so that was 1% apiece. Walk Don't Run sold 1 million, you know,
sure,
at the time. That gave us $10,000 apiece for 1 million sales.
Wow.
Quite different today.
Yeah, definitely. So the band sort of moves to Los Angeles. What was that scene like, the mid-60s, the scene at Liberty, a lot of creative artists on that label, and, you know, a lot of hype, a lot of desperation to sell records, you know?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, yeah, we went down to Los Angeles, and it was like, we really enjoyed the city. I mean, a couple of guys, you know, pretty naive from Tacoma, Washington, getting into that music business, that piranha bowl in Los Angeles with the record companies, and we were pretty naive, so obviously they could tell us just about anything. We're saying, oh, okay, you know. And, you know, it takes you a long time to learn not just to say, okay, you know, you got to... question something here and there.
Yeah,
then we got back up. We got up to 6%. Oh my gosh, we were in heaven then.
Yeah, a 50% raise.
Yeah.
At some point, I'm not sure who's responsible, but you guys were on tour, and there was a couple of Ventures records that feature no Ventures, right?
You know, we were out of town, and well, no, never no Ventures.
Okay,
never none. But there was always at least one of us. And, you know, if we were on the road or something, somebody would stay back and we'd replace them. But that happened very rarely, very rarely. And then, you know, our producers and the record companies, if I knew what I know now, I would never allow that to happen.
Hmm.
But I must say it did happen, yeah. And there's maybe three or four out there that... have different musicians, you know, except one Venture.
Well, I know that Venture's fans are you know, people familiar with, especially the guitar style, it's very easy to pick out the songs that aren't, you know, Bob
Yeah,
Ranocchi.
It is.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you guys are touring. You guys are, you know, just putting out record after record after record. Eventually, I think it's 1962, Howie Johnson injured in an auto accident, and you get Mel Taylor, who was the house drummer at the Palomino, played country bands, also played other instruments besides drums, I found out.
Well, he played guitar, but I never heard him play the guitar. But he was born in New York City,
right?
And he moved to Johnson City, Tennessee. There's a switch for you.
Yeah,
cultural. Anyway, then there's a picture of him playing the guitar with a group at that time. But he was an excellent drummer.
Yeah,
and. You know, I think that he should have got a lot more credit than he did over the years.
Mel Taylor, I agree. Once that part of the puzzle sort of got together, what they call the classic lineup of the Ventures was born, and the sound sort of solidified. Just an amazingly powerful drummer, and, you know, your rhythm guitar style and him just locked together there, and, you know, just a really amazing musician.
Yeah, it did. And you know, people say, well, how did you get your sound? Well, I say it comes natural. You know, we don't try to get it. And the reason is that when Bob and I first started, it's like I said, we didn't know a drummer or a bass player. Didn't know one. So it was just he and I playing. I tried to make up for the drums and played a very percussion-y style rhythm. You know, really hitting it hard, and Bob would, when he played lead, he would use the whammy bar, you know?
Right.
And every once in a while, instead of a note, he'd hit a chord, just to kind of make up for any keyboards or saxophone or bass or whatever that we needed. But... that's the way our style got put together.
Yeah, very interesting. And so eventually you start these trips to Japan in the 60s, and I think some people don't quite understand the phenomenon of the Ventures in Japan. You're bigger than the Beatles, right?
Well, we sold, not now, because, you know, we have kind of, we've gone there and overexposed ourselves so damn many times. And I'll tell you, in the early days when the Beatles first came out, we outsold them. Toshiba Records had both of us. They had the Beatles and the Ventures. And so I know this for a fact. We didn't just outsell the Beatles. We outsold them 2-1.
Mm.
And we first went there in 1962. Nobody ever heard of us. And it was just Bob and I still. In 1962, we had the group, but... the promoter in Japan said, I can't afford four people. They were just getting into rock and roll. And so he said, I can't afford two people. I can only afford two. So Bob and I went. Nobody had ever heard of us. We were the opening duo for Bobby V. You know who Bobby V is?
Sure.
And I don't know if you know a girl named Joanne Campbell.
Yeah, I've heard her records.
Yeah, anyway, she was the headliner.
Mm.
She had a movie released in Japan, a twist movie with Joey D and the Starlighters.
Yeah.
And so she was pretty popular in Japan at that time. So she was the headliner, and nobody ever heard of us. We came back 2 years later with our full group. And there were 5,000 people at the airport saying, welcome the Ventures.
Wow.
They had been playing our music in anywhere you go. Loudspeakers in the streets and, coffee houses, radio stations, TV, everywhere.
In 1965, you had 5 of the top 10 singles for the year in Japan. That's incredible.
Oh, yeah.
It's an amazing... An amazing, and you're still going back there all the time, and it's still, you know, Ventures mania over there.
Oh yeah, it's still sold out. I mean, you know, we go there twice a year. We go and play the Blue Note clubs, which are jazz clubs, and I think we're the only rock artists that ever play there. And they hold, I think, about 400 or 500 people, and then we do two shows for two different audiences. And they charge $150 to get in.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, in Japan, they charge $50 or $55 or whatever it might be just for our concerts.
Hmm. Yeah.
And they're usually 90% sold out, at least 90.
Yeah. I just finished reading this new book by Dale Halderman, and it's a book that you collaborated on. It's called Walk, Don't Run, The Story of the Ventures. It's 380 large pages.
Yes, it is.
Filled with photos and filled with more information than I assume you could remember. I mean, it seems like more than a brain's worth of information.
Well, you know, he actually got to a lot of people that were connected with the Ventures at the time that we worked with. And he interviewed a lot of people. And there's just some things I don't remember, of course, you know. And my partner, Bob, he gave him 50 pages. And then, you know, he and my mom actually wrote the book.
Hmm. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. One of the interesting things, it's like a story that, a saga, really, that goes on throughout the book is your relationship with the Mostrite guitars and Semi Mostrite, the man who made those guitars. I mean, that's a whole nother book, really.
See? Yeah, it is. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there's a lot of things in there that if I would have started helping him right to begin with, it took him 9 years to write this book.
Yeah, it's giant.
He would have had a lot more information and a lot more interesting things that happened, not just, you know, more or less factual things.
Hmm. Tell me a little, just very briefly, tell me about Semi Mostrite, what kind of a guy he was, and are those guitars great-sounding guitars, easy to play?
Yeah, well, what happened was that Noki met Semi Mosley, is his name.
Right.
He passed away, but somewhere in the early 90s, I believe. And Noki met him and knew that he was a guitar maker, and he said to Noki, why don't you play this guitar and take it on the road, and I'll give you $50 for everyone that, you know, you have somebody order one, and I'll give you $50 if I sell it to him. So he did that, and then we thought, hey, let's all get behind Mosrite. And so we did, and we all picked up Mosrite guitars. And we thought that the neck was a little bit on the thin side, you know, and narrow. And we tried to have him, if we're going to put our name on it, we want it to be the way we want it. But he was stubborn, and he wouldn't do it. He said, no, I don't do this, and I don't do that. So he was hard to work with, and not a good businessman.
Yeah,
he went bankrupt eventually.
It seemed like he went bankrupt a number of times and ended up sort of going behind your back and didn't work out well, and back to Fenders and lots of other
well, that's right,
guitars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what happened was that he called me at one time, you know. It cost us a fortune for him to go bankrupt in those days, a lot of money. Because we were the distributor. It was set up terribly wrong. We were the distributor, and he was the manufacturer. Well, we're at his mercy. You know, if we don't get guitars from him, we have nothing to distribute. Mm. So what happened was he went bankrupt, and then we had a lot of accounts receivable that when people know that he went bankrupt, and, you know, retailers, they didn't pay us.
Yeah.
They paid about half of what they owed us, and that cost us, I would say, at that time, and you can imagine at that time how much that would be now, about $150,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Which would be probably 800 or a million right now.
Yeah, so back on the road and make some more records quick, back to business. 1969, you had a number four hit with Hawaii Five-0.
Right.
One of the greatest rock songs of all time. I mean, it just always sounds fantastic. Tell me how you, how did you hear the song? Did you hear the TV show, or was that, or was your version?
Well, what happened was that we had an engineer that had done things with us before Hawaii Five-0 TV show ever came out. And he had gotten a hold of Mel, our drummer, and said, you know, the guy that wrote the song, is not, he's only got a 30-second version of it for the TV show. Now, what you hear on the TV show is not The Ventures. We did source music, you know, it's kind of behind-the-scenes music, mm-hmm. background music, but we didn't do the theme. And so he had called Mel and said he's only got a 30-minute version of it. I mean, a 30-second version, and he's not going to release it. Why don't you guys go in and record it? So we did. And, you know, we used like 25 pieces on it, you know, horns and the woodwinds and percussion and all kinds of different things.
Yeah, I always want to know, when you were finished it, listening to the mix in the studio, did you all sort of have an inkling? Did you go, okay, this song is a hit?
I thought it was, but, you know, nobody else did. And the exposure on the TV show should have meant something. So I just didn't quite understand why it wasn't immediately accepted. We recorded it in 1968, and and we released it, and nobody would play it. We'd send it to stations, and we finally hired a record promoter, somebody that goes around to the stations or writes letters or whatever and says, you know, this is a good record, will you play it? And nobody would play it. So anyway, he finally got a breakout, you know, what they call a breakout. Somebody started playing it a lot. Mm-hmm. And so he'd call all the other stations that he had called before, many, you know, 20, 25, 30, the top stations in different cities. And he said, I got a breakout on Hawaii 5-0. And they said, where? And he said, Hawaii. They weren't too impressed with that. Right. So anyway, finally, it got a breakout in, believe it or not, Sacramento, California, and went to number one. And so that's how it got started. Everybody started playing it then.
Very interesting. Let me remind the folks, we're listening to Don Wilson here of The Ventures, and it's WFMU East Orange, WXHC Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Eventually, Noki begins his first divorce from the band. He's come and gone a few times from the band, and Jerry McGee joins, another fantastic guitar player. Also during this time, sometimes there was keyboard players in the band.
Right.
People forget that. There's some great keyboard, organ-fueled Ventures records out there.
There is. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Leon Russell was was on a lot of our recordings with a keyboard.
Hmm. And then the 70s come, and it's kind of a weird time for the Ventures, a weird time for America and for the music business. There's disco. At one point, you guys added singers to the band, and then all of a sudden, new wave music comes, and you know, the Ventures are sort of rediscovered, even though you really still were making records that whole time. Sort of your first rediscovery at that moment.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there was a disc jockey in Los Angeles named Rodney Bingenheimer, and he had an avant-garde station there playing this kind of punk stuff.
Right.
And he would play some Venture stuff that would fit in that station, and people were calling up saying, who's that new wave group, the Ventures?
That's funny.
So, yeah, we get instrumentals are tough. I mean, they're really tough.
Yeah.
I think it's quite phenomenal what we have done, even if I have to blow my own horn, you know. It's quite phenomenal what we've done with instrumentals.
Yeah, you don't have to blow your own horn, because the numbers really speak for themselves. Over 100 million records sold. I mean, it's just sort of unbelievable, including the Lively Ones version of Surf Rider, which is a Venture song, turns up in the Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Absolutely.
That must have sold a fortune for you guys. A nice extra, you know, put a new roof on your house or something.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, it would just almost not put a roof on it. It would buy it. But anyway, that was just as composers, because I'll tell you how that happened. Somebody came into our office, in like 1962, 3, 4, something like that. And it was a manager of this group called the Lively Ones, and he says, guys, I got a song that sounds like your song, and we put it together. I want you to listen to it and see if it's too close or whatever. He plays it, and I said, "What are you talking about? That is the song."
Oh, that's pretty funny.
And then what happened was that Quentin Tarantino, who did Pulp Fiction, who directed,
yeah,
he all the songs that are in that in the CD from the movie, the soundtrack, are all things that he had in his own record collection. And it's an odd bunch of different things, but that's probably up to 6 times platinum by now.
Yeah, it is one of those...
Unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable things. Finally, March 2008, you're inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It took a long time. Why did it take so long, and how did you feel about that?
Well, you know, I had given up on it. I always told people, I said, I'm not crazy about the word posthumously. You know, you get your award posthumously, which means you're dead.
Right, you want it while you're alive to enjoy it.
Absolutely. No, we've been eligible for 22 years to get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And being the biggest selling instrumental group in music history, not just rock.
Yeah.
In music history, you'd think that would be enough.
Yeah, just enough,
but,
just right
but,
there.
22 years of being passed by, we're thinking, wow, I don't think we're ever going to get in.
It's very odd. The people who get in that thing, I just don't understand it. It just makes no sense whatsoever to me.
No, I know.
Yeah, but
I agree with you.
It looked like a lot of fun that night, and finally redeemed that on your 50th anniversary.
Right, yeah.
Let me ask you, how's Bob's health?
His health is not very good. Not very good.
Okay.
And without going into it a lot, he's kind of guarded with that, but he's not well.
Okay. And the band is playing Friday, October 17th at BB King's right here in New York City, as well as a bunch of other dates, including back to Japan again. And folks can check theventures.com for more information. And I do want people to check out that book, Walk, Don't Run, The Story of the Ventures, Dale Halterman, and your mother and yourself and Bob all collaborated that. 380 giant pages of juicy material. Tell me, what is the future? What, besides playing at BB King's on the 17th, what are you going to do? Are you going to keep being a venture forever?
Well, I'm 75 years old. You know, I mean, in February I'll be 76. But I'm in good health. I'm in great health.
You sound great.
Yeah, and I mean, nobody can believe it. They say, if I say I'm 75, what? Get out of here! No, but anyway, from what we did in Japan, just give you an idea. I'm used to it because I've been doing it for a long time, traveling in Japan, and sometimes when you leave the hotel and go to do a show, you leave at 9:30 in the morning and you don't get back until 11:30 at night. And that's travel.
Yeah, that's exhausting.
And then getting there early for sound check, and then you do your show. And then you get back in the van, or if it's a train or whatever. I defy a 20-year-old to do what I do at 75 years old.
So are you going to keep doing it?
I'm going to go for... I just signed a 2-year contract for Japan.
All right.
And, I think that may be enough. I'll see how I feel at that time.
Yeah,
I'll be 77, so...
Wow.
You know, I mean, look at Les Paul. My God, he's still playing at 92.
Right, why not? Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, that's another thing we're doing, is we're going to... and I can't remember the date. I think it's sometime in November. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are saluting Les Paul. And they want us there, along with a lot of other artists that are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so we're going to do that, and that's sometime in November.
So that'll be a guitar-oriented evening. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It will be a lot of fun, yeah. And hopefully he'll be there. They're not sure whether he can make it or not, you know.
But yeah, I saw him a couple years
ago.
He's still great, and he's still kind of got a little bit of a sense of humor, which is, I think, vital to stay young.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. Don Wilson of The Venture, is really great to talk to you. I've got Walk, Don't Run, the first version. Of course, it was a big hit twice.
Yes, it was.
I've got the first version queued up here for the folks. Anything else? We did sort of discuss this song, but anything else we need to know about the...
Well, I don't think so. I don't know. It's, you pretty much covered it all. But if anybody wants to buy that book, and I think that, you know, I have had some people that said, I had never heard of The Ventures, but my brother-in-law, who is a fan, bought me the book, and I read it, and I couldn't put it down.
Yeah, I thought
that's how interesting that book is. But, you know, if somebody will go to our website, which is www.theventures.com, it will put it, give you a link to the publisher. And, you know, if you're interested in buying the book.
Yeah, that's exactly how I got it, and it came in about 2 days, so...
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Uh-huh.
And, again, Friday, October 17th at B.B. King's, the Venture.
Right. We always have a wonderful time there, so, you know, I mean, our music is considered to be, you know, good time, fun music.
Yeah. Don, perhaps I'll see you down at B.B. King's and you know, get some rest, catch up from your jet lag, and thanks for visiting
us. I want to meet you down there.
All right. I'll come by and I'll say hi.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it.
All right. Don Wilson, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I brought some ribbons for your hair, fancy perfumes you can wear, and there is still a whole lot more. I brought love like you've never known before. I brought some records you can play, I'll bring you new ones every day, and there is still a whole lot more. I'll bring you love like you've never known before. There isn't anything that I would not do, or at least try, just to keep you satisfied, just to keep you by my side. I'll send you letters every day if you ever go away, and there is still a whole lot more. I'll send you love like you've never known before. There isn't anything that I would not do, or at least try, just to keep you satisfied, just to keep you by my side. There isn't anything that I would not do, or at least try, just to keep you satisfied, just to keep you by my side. I'll send you letters every day if you ever go away, and there is still a whole lot more. I'll send you love like you've never known before.